eko chalovan ishate ishanibihi sarvam lokan ishata ishanibihi evaika udbhave sambhavecha Ya etad vidur amitaste bhavanti. The controller of all rules alone with his sovereign powers. With his sovereign powers, he rules all the worlds in both generation and annihilation. Whoever knows him becomes immortal. First, the word Isha means Lord, controller. It's from the verb Ish, to control. So Ishate is the verb. It means he controls. He is the controller. And it says, by his Ishani, bihi. Bi means by. It's an ending showing the agent. Ishani, bi. Ishani. That's the feminine form of Isha. Just like Lord Shiva is called Isha, his wife Parvati is called Ishani, or alternative form of that is Ishani. So this means the Supreme Person's energies, who are also controllers, but they're female because they're his potencies, his energies. So he controls with his female counterparts through his energies. He doesn't have to personally look after the control of the universe. His energies do it for him. But someone, okay, the commentator says someone may raise an objection. There's only one Supreme Lord, one Supreme Controller. How can he create so many universes, and each universe is so complex? How can he do this all himself? There must actually be more than one. There must be many creators. That's the objection. It's answered. No, all the creators that you can think of, like Brahma and the different Prajapatis and material nature herself, they're all his potencies, his Shaktis. He alone creates using these energies of his. He's the only creator. He's called Jalavan in the first verse. Jala means net, like a fisherman's net. It also means the net of illusion. Indrajal means magic. So Jalavan can also be understood figuratively as meaning a magician. As a display of magic, he creates the universe. And Maya also means magic. In vernacular language. So Mayavi, possessor of Maya, also is a word meaning magician. He has his Ishanis, his controlling energies. These are nature herself, time, the karma, and individual personalities of the jivas. These are his creative energies by which he produces the universe. And the demigods, Virinchi, rather Brahma, Rudra and other demigods, these are all his energies too, his personal energies. And through their agency, he creates the universe and maintains it. So there's a relationship of achincha bheda, inconceivably sameness and difference between him and his creative energies. They have no independent function or existence, but they're autonomous. They have their personal individual identities, their free will, and they've, at least is the living entities like Maya herself and the demigods, they are voluntarily engaging in his service. That is their proper exercise of free will. If you want to also become a demigod, you can't become Maya, but you can become a demigod if you want. And that can be accomplished simply by voluntarily being a servant of the Supreme Lord. By exercise of your free will, autonomous free will. Okay, another objection, well, a similar objection. same person is trying to argue that there's not just one creator, there are many demigods who are all considered creators, especially Brahma. You want some water? He said, okay, you've defeated my logic, my logical argument that there's more than one creator, but all the same, the Puranas and other literatures say just this, that Brahma is the creator, or sometimes some other demigod is called the creator, or nature is called the creator. So are we going to just ignore all these scriptural statements? And, for example, in the Chandogya Upanishad, it says, and sometimes the material elements are called the agency of creation. Certain material elements. As for example, Chandogya Upanishad. Sarvani ha vaimani bhutani akashareva samudpadyante akasham patyastam yanti. All things that are created arise out of the ether. And when they're dissolved again, they go back to the ether. So, it seems to say the ether is the agency of creation. And in the Smriti Shastra, the Manu Samhita, it's described how Brahma creates the universe. Apa eva sasarja adau. At first he created the waters. Tasu bijam avasvajat. And he placed the seed of the universe in the waters. Tadannam abhavat daimam. That seed turned into a golden egg. Sahasram shusam apavam, as effulgent as 1,000 suns. And Brahma is said to have done this. So the answer to this objection, that there seems to be scriptural statements describing various personalities and even various elements of nature as the creator, the answer is, this Akash, ether, and Indra, and Brahma, and so on, these are all the energies of the Supreme Person. And it's by these energies, personal and impersonal, that he does the creating. They're his vibhutis, his opulent expansions. Just like a tree has its branches, its sub-branches, and flowers and fruits, these opulences of the tree are not different than the tree. They don't exist separately. He alone is the creator both in manifesting the universe and dissolving it. And when he dissolves the universe, all these secondary creators, they are all merged back in him again. They don't even retain their separate existence during the time of annihilation. They exist separately as jivas, but they're not functioning separately while they're sleeping inside the body of Mahavishnu. This is all possible by the Supreme's inconceivable potencies. Therefore, he's called a magician, Jalavana, because this is his inconceivable power through his inconceivable energies. Okay, we'll go on to the second verse. Eko hi rudro nadvitiyaya tastu ya iman lokan ishata ishani bihi pratyam janas tishtati sankucho chantakale samsvidya vishwa bhuvanani gopa. The Supreme Lord Rudra alone. The Supreme Lord Rudra stands alone with no equal. He rules all these worlds with his sovereign energies. He manifests to all within, residing in their hearts. At the time of annihilation, he destroys all the worlds, and then he sends them forth again and maintains them. So here the Supreme Person is being called Rudra. The name Rudra can be applied to the Supreme Person because it can be understood as meaning one who destroys or dissolves dravayati. Dru, or dra, means to dissolve. And ruj means the disease of material existence. Ruj means disease. So one who dissolves the disease of material existence, he's called Rudra. In other words, he's the one who gives liberation from samsara. So nobody stands as his partner. He has no partner, no one equal to him, and he doesn't need anybody else's help, even in the work of creating the material world. And there's nobody else who's capable of giving liberation but him. So someone may question, wait a minute, the name Rudra is commonly understood to be the name of Lord Shiva, not of Vishnu. And shouldn't we, this is called, technically called Rudra meaning, the meaning that is conventional. The person, Shiva, conventionally, everybody accepts that Shiva is the Rudra is the name of Lord Shiva. That's the way the word is usually used. But the logical argument is given here by the commentator that we should put aside the conventional meaning in this case and take the analytic meaning. When you analyze the word syllable by syllable, what it actually means. Rudra is the name of a person, but it has a meaning too. That is called the analytic meaning, or the literal, the. And now, by analyzing the word, you will get that meaning. And the meaning is Rudra, the person who delivers from material entanglement, or who dissolves, who cures the disease of material existence. And you shouldn't complain that this is a false argument. Because in a case, this is the technically so, in the science of poetics, of how to, which part of that science of writing and reading poetry is to understand how words have literal meanings, they have figurative meanings, and there are two basic kinds of meanings of a word. A word that is just, a meaning that is just conventional, or a meaning that is derived by some grammatical connection. Just like the word pankaja can be understood by analyzing it. It has components that have meaning. Panka means mud. Ja means born. Something born in the mud can be called pankaja. And it's applied to the lotus, because lotuses, although they're very elegant, beautiful flowers, they're born in mud. And then the common name for lotus is pankaja. But another name for lotus, padma, doesn't have any such... You can't dissect the word padma. It doesn't mean anything else. It doesn't have parts that have separate meanings. So that's just a conventional meaning. The word padma and its meaning is just conventional. But the word pankaja has an analytic meaning. Two different basic kinds of meaning. Some words have only one, some words have both. Like the name Rudra can be understood both ways. So in the case that you have a word that always has a conventional meaning, like Rudra, but you have a special case where the analytic meaning of the word makes special sense in the context, like here. In this context, we're talking about the giver of liberation and how to attain liberation. So to call someone the dissolver of the material illness, that very much fits the context. Therefore, the analytic meaning is appropriate here. And when, the rule is, when the analytic meaning is appropriate, it should be given precedence over the conventional meaning. When the literal meaning of the name fits the context, then you should put aside the convention if it contradicts. If they contradict, then you take the analytic meaning when the analytic meaning makes good sense in the context. So here, in this context, analytic meaning makes very good sense. And there's some contradiction in calling Rudra Shiva here, calling Lord Shiva Rudra here. Because the whole Upanishad is dedicating itself to the Supreme Person, not to some secondary person. Not to someone who only controls material energy. So we can also understand the name Rudra here refers to the Lord being the destroyer. Lord Shiva is simply his energy again, and is destroying on behalf of the Supreme. But the Supreme Person is himself responsible for the annihilation of the universe, just as he's responsible for its creation Okay, we'll go on to the third verse. Yes, Professor. But, yes, Rudra is also a creator, so is Brahma. But in this verse, we have to understand Rudra is not meaning Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva is not the he's not the Supreme Person. He may be the destroyer, but he's not the creator. He's not, you know, there's so many qualities listed here, not only in this verse, but the other verses that go with it. Qualities that don't fit Lord Shiva. Even though you on one point you can say it sounds like Lord Shiva, especially the name sounds like his name, and this mention of destruction sounds like his quality, but the other qualities are not his, they're only Vishnu's qualities. Creator, super soul who's in everybody's heart, regulator of everything, these are all qualities only of Vishnu, not of Shiva. Of course, the devotees of Lord Shiva may like to claim that these are his qualities, but they're actually Lord Vishnu's qualities. Well, although that power is of giving liberation, the power to give liberation belongs to Lord Vishnu alone. He has given that power specifically to Lord Shiva and his wife. On his behalf, they're allowed to give liberation to their devotees. Not independently, but he has given them, he's given them that deputized power. That's stated in the scripture. Okay, so he can be called Rudra also, because he also can exercise on behalf of Vishnu the power to give liberation. Okay. Now we'll go on to the third verse. This is more about Lord Rudra. Yo devanam pabhavascho badvascho dbhavascha vishvadipo rudro maharshihi hiranya garbham janayama sapurvam sano buddhya shubhaya samyunaktu. Lord Rudra, the greatest mystic, is the creator and empowerer of the demigods. I'm at four. Did I skip three? Okay. Back to three. I turned the page over. Okay, verse three. This verse three is from the Yajurveda with slight changes. So I'll try to read it with the original intonation. Vishvatas chakshur uta vishvato muko vishvato bahur uta vishvatas tata sambahu bhyam namati sampatatrayar yavapitivi janayam deva ekaha. Everywhere are his eyes, mouths, arms, and legs. With his two arms and his wing-like feet, the effulgent Lord regulates the sky and earth, which he alone created. Well, if you don't like the idea, if you don't like to meditate on Krishna with 1,000 heads and 1,000 arms, if that feature of the Lord is not very attractive to you, Rang Ramanuja suggests an alternative. You can understand this to mean that he engages all the jivas in his service by using their arms and legs. He's the controller of everybody. Even though the jivas are autonomous, they have their own free will and they have their own power of locomotion. They can move their own arms and legs. They're not his arms and legs, literally. But he acts through the jivas. They're his agents. Everybody is serving Krishna, either willingly or unwillingly. So in that sense, indirectly, he has everybody's arms and legs and heads and arms and feet. And he, although he takes control of everybody, he doesn't get entangled by this process of controlling the universe. He himself is not affected by his own maya. He, in another sense, you can understand he's taking himself the form of the Virat Rupa, the universal form, and creating the universe from that universal form. The universal form that when the lotus flower appears out of the navel of Garbhodakshayi Vishnu, it's described in the Bhagavatam that the universal form is that lotus stem. And from that lotus stem is contained the blueprints of everything in creation, the prototypes. Just like you may build, they're building MVT, so the apartments are all the same. There's one plan, and there may be 50 apartments all built on the same plan. There only has to be one set of diagrams for the 50 houses. Like that, for each species of life, each planet, each individual thing in the universe, there's one prototype, one blueprint. All of those blueprints are stored in the universal form. And Lord Brahma has the power. He's the engineer. He knows how to read the blueprints. He has access to them and the authority to construct the universe. But it's Lord Vishnu who expands this universal form originally from himself. He takes on this form. And in this way, in this sense, for someone to create the whole universe, he has to have. To create a whole universe, you need countless eyes, arms, legs. To be able to successfully execute such a task. The Mayavadis may say that literally all the arms and legs are the Supreme's arms and legs, because everyone is one. Now, but that is false. We understand, the Vaishnava understanding is that everything is his energy, but at the same time, one with him but different at the same time. So it says here, he has eyes everywhere, Vishvatas Chakshur, Vishvatomukho. These are, first of all, the eye is a knowledge-acquiring sense. By the mention of him having eyes everywhere, that implies the other senses also that are used for acquiring knowledge, like the ears, the nose, the tongue. And by the mouth, the arms, and the legs, these imply the active senses. These are three of the active senses and imply the other ones also. All these senses of everybody are controlled by Lord Rishikesh. On his own behalf, he engages human beings on the earth to create and maintain the universe. Sambahu Byam Namati. Sam Namati. He controls, he regulates with his arms, using the arms of the human beings on the earth. And in the heavens, he uses the limbs, bodily limbs, of those creatures like the Gandharvas and demigods who can fly in the sky. So that's why he says, it says here, with his wings. Because there are other creatures, higher beings, who can fly in the ether, in the sky, like demigods. And the Lord also has his wings, by which he controls, through their limbs, by which they can even fly in the sky, he creates the heavens. Patatraya means wings, in the third line. Okay, we can go on to the fourth verse. Again, I'll read it. Yo devanam bhavavash chod bhavash cha vishwadipo rudro maharshihi hiranya garbham janayama sapurvam sano buddhya shubhaya samyunaktu. Lord Rudra, the greatest mystic, is the creator and empowerer of the demigods. The ultimate ruler of the universe. In the beginning he begot Hiranyagarbha Brahma. May he bestow on us good intelligence. So here's Rudra again. This verse is not only further describing the glories of the Supreme, but it also is a prayer. It's a prayer for the power to realize the personality of Godhead. May he bestow good intelligence on us. Good intelligence for realizing him. The demigods are all born from the personality of Godhead, And they're all empowered by him. All their powers come from him. They may think, demigods, that they are the enjoyers and masters of sacrifice, that they're controlling the universe. But actually, being the enjoyer of sacrifices and being the controller of the universe, that's the privilege of the Supreme Person only. They may be Prajapatis, progenitors of mankind. They may be, Lord Shiva has the title Pashupati, the lord of all creatures. But they get these privileges from him. They actually belong to Lord Vishnu. So he's called Rudra again because he dispels the delusion of the world. And he's called Maharshi also, which is explained to mean that he possesses the extreme limit of omniscience. He's fully aware of everything, directly and indirectly. So these are qualities not of some demigod. These are qualities only of the Supreme Person. And it's described in the third line how the first Prajapati, the first progenitor of mankind, Lord Brahma, is born from Vishnu. The prayer is here, therefore, may he bestow intelligence on us. Intelligence that is clearly focused on the highest objective of life. Of course, in these verses, the glories of the Lord are being described in terms of his creating and maintaining the universe. This is only a secondary definition of what is God. Primary quality of God is his transcendental life, his enjoyment of his pastimes with his pure devotees, primarily in the spiritual world. But because we don't know about that spiritual world, we're ignorant of it. In the Vedanta, in the Upanishads, primarily, mostly, the glories of God are described in terms of his creating and maintaining this world. Because that's what we're familiar with. That's what we understand. Okay. There is some comment here on this, based on this verse from the Vedanta Sutra, first chapter, fourth part of the first chapter, Sutra number 28. Govinda Bhash is discussing here. Okay, in this first chapter of Vedanta Sutra, Vyasadeva is attempting to show the consistency of all the Upanishads and all the Vedas, that they're all describing and glorifying the one absolute truth. They're not proposing different demigods as the supreme. They're not saying that the forces of nature or any demigod is independent. The consistent overview is that the one absolute truth is the controller and regulator of everything and the source origin of everything. But it seems, now someone objects, but we read statements in, for example, the Shvetashvatara Upanishad that seem to contradict this proposal. There's a statement in the first chapter that we read, verse 10 of the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. Kshanam padanam amitakshanam haraha. Material nature is infallible. And Lord Hara, which is the name of Lord Shiva commonly, is also immortal and infallible. And now we have this verse, these two verses from the third chapter. Eko Rudra na dvitiya tastu. Rudra alone is the supreme, and no one else stands equal to him. And the verse 4, Yo devanam pavavas chod bhavascha. Vishradi po Rudra Shiva Rudra Maharshi. He's the greatest mystic, the creator, Lord Rudra, an empowerer of the demigods, the ultimate ruler of the universe. Etc. There are other verses in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad similar to that. So there's a doubt. These words, Hara and Rudra, aren't these names of Lord Shiva? Or, as you propose, are they actually names of the Supreme Brahman, Absolute Truth? Well, since everywhere these names, Hara and Rudra, are considered names of Shiva, everyone thinks this is Lord Shiva, we should accept that, that this is actually glorifying Lord Shiva as an independent controller, as supreme in his own right. So Vyasadeva answers in the sutra. He says, Etena sarve vyakyata by all these terms, these names, are explained as referring to the Supreme. The Baladev Yerushalmi, he comments, following our analysis of how the Vedas are consistent in all the Upanishads glorify the same absolute truth without contradiction. If we follow that whole consistent argument, we'll understand that the names, the words, Hara, Rudra, and so on, are actually referring to the absolute truth. Because we should understand that all names ultimately belong to Lord Vishnu. They're, ultimately, every name is his name. There are statements in scripture that make this point. If you look on page 42, you can see these verses. Shruti, which is no longer exists, but is quoted by various commentators, says, Namani Vishvani Nasanti Loke Yadavirasid Purushasya Sarvam Namani Sarvani Yama Vishanti Tamvai Vishnum Param Udaharanti. No one's name in this world originates from the person himself. Rather, all names refer ultimately to Lord Vishnu, because they all belong to him. So you can have a son and call him Krishna, or a daughter and call him her Radha, but that you're borrowing that name. That's not the original owner of that name. You're naming the person in honor of the original Krishna and Radha. Similarly, all the names of the demigods don't originate from those demigods. They're borrowed. They're loaned to the demigods by Krishna. They're his names. And another statement from Smriti, Srinarayana Adini Namani Vinayanyani Rudradibhyo Harir Datovan. Lord Hari gave all his own names, except for some of them, like Srinarayan, to other persons, demigods like Rudra. The powers, the names, even the physical appearance of the demigods are borrowed, they're loaned to them by Lord Vishnu, because they're all his names, his powers, his appearances. And finally, Baladev Vidyabhushan states that there's a rule how to properly interpret when a name might be a name of Vishnu, it might be a name of a demigod. So the rule to follow is that if there's no contradiction in allowing the name to refer to a demigod, if it doesn't contradict the philosophy or the consistency of the context, okay, let it refer to the demigod. But if it creates a contradiction, then you have to take the name as referring to Vishnu only, even if it goes against convention. The philosophical consistency and the consistency of the context is the ruling principle. No, they're all intending to describe Brahman, the absolute truth. But that is a partial realization, only a partial realization of Krishna. The Upanishads start from the impersonal point of view, understanding the Supreme without looking at his personal qualities. You know, sort of going around the Supreme from a distance and identifying him uniquely as the one basis of all existence, the origin of everything, and then describing him negatively as having no material qualities, having no material name, having no beginning, no end. This defines the absolute truth, but only partially, only a very vague beginning of realization of the absolute truth. That's what Brahman is. It's not that there's a separate thing, a impersonal, feature of the Supreme. It's not separate. It is Krishna. But it's Krishna being viewed at a very great distance. That's explained by Jiva Goswami in the Bhagavad Sandarbha. When someone begins to realize Krishna, but he cannot recognize Krishna's personal qualities, that's Brahman realization. Just like you're approaching a mountain from a great distance, and all you can see is that there's some big thing in front of you. You can't distinguish any features of it. That's impersonal realization. That's what we call it, Brahman, the biggest thing. Because it's just some big thing in front of us. So we call it the biggest thing, Brahman. It's as if the Upanishads are written for people who have an impersonal tendency, but it's trying to raise them to gradually to the personal consciousness. You can approach Krishna and get pretty close to him by the process of jnana. It's stated in the Brahma Samhita. Ultimately, he's inconceivable by jnana. You cannot logically understand Krishna, even by the authorized statements of the Upanishads. But you can almost, it says, yet prapadasimya vachincha. He remains inconceivable. The yogis, traveling at the speed of the mind by their meditation, can't get very close. The jnanis can get close, but not close enough. Traveling at the speed of the yogis travel at the speed of the wind by their breathing exercises. The jnanis, exercising their mind, travel at the speed of the mind. And they're chasing after Krishna, they just barely begin to see this effulgence. They see the brilliant light of Brahman. What is that? That's the reflection of Krishna's toes. So they almost touch his toes, but not quite. They almost get their hands on him. Almost personal realization, but not quite. So through the process of jnana, which is what is basically taught in the Upanishads, you can approach the personal realization of the truth, but you can't quite get your hands on it. When the Upanishads begin to actually describe devotional service, then you can have real personal realization. There's some of that here in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, and in other Upanishads also. Sometimes it's disguised, because not everybody who's going to read these Upanishads can appreciate. So the personal teachings, the devotional teachings, may be presented somewhat disguised. Just like here, it's talking about Lord Vishnu, but he's being called Rudra, just as a disguise. Because many readers are not going to be ready to accept a Vaishnava scripture. They'll throw it out. If it says Vaishnava on the cover, they'll throw it out. So instead it says Rudra. The Upanishads, especially, because of the Jnanakanda, this is for people who want to approach the Supreme through their understanding. They don't want to surrender their independence, but they also don't want to work. You know, they want to sit and think. And by understanding everything, they want to become perfect. Not by surrendering. Especially not by surrendering to anybody in particular, especially not Krishna. So, for them, they want an impersonal approach. So that's what's given to them. At the same time, the sages are trying to push them into something better, gradually. Well, the Vyasadeva and the other sages. Yes, they can actually attain pure devotional service if they follow this process under the guidance of a pure devotee. You know, just like where Prabhupada sent his disciples out in the street to sell books. You know, that looks like a karmic activity. My father used to sell, you know, Encyclopedia Britannica. You know, that was a mundane activity. You know, I wasn't very good at books, but to always go out and sell like encyclopedia salesman, same exact activity. But that becomes, you know, the means of attaining love of God. So, because it was taught by a pure devotee, you can be engaged in anything by one who is an actual pure devotee, and you'll become a pure devotee too. So by studying the Upanishads, you can become a pure devotee if the teacher is a pure devotee. It depends on who you hear it from. Here?
Yeah.
Well, we don't really know what ultimately is the personal position of Shvetashvatara Rishi. We don't know if he's actually a Vaishnava. He doesn't name Lord Vishnu. So, if he's a Vaishnava, he's keeping it low key. He's not openly preaching Krishna consciousness here. But in any case, the Vaishnava Acharyas always quote from these Upanishads. They're standard authority about the basic science of spiritual life. Now, I may not describe the intimate aspects, but we have to understand the basic aspects first. You know, that we are eternal spirit souls, we're not this body, we're servants of God. And many statements from the Upanishads give very strong authority to establish these points. So all the Vaishnava commentators, all the Vaishnava acharyas are constantly quoting from these Upanishads. Prabhupada did too. Well, we'll see, especially in the sixth chapter. There are many famous verses that will come up, especially in the last chapter. Because Baladev Vidyabhushan did, the Prabhupada based his comment with verse number five of the third chapter. This is also a verse from the Yajurveda, 16th chapter, Vaidyasayati Samhita. Yate Rudva Shiva Tonur Agora Apokashini Tayanas Tanuva Shanta Moya Giri Shanta Bichakashihi. Okay, there's a mistake here. It talks about personal forms, plural. It's supposed to be singular, so I'm going to change the translation. O Rudra, your auspicious personal form is not fearful. It destroys all sins. In that gentle form, O bestower of favor, who resides on the mountains, please glance mercifully upon us. On us. This is similar to the verse in the Bhagavad Gita where Arjuna prays to Krishna who has appeared in his universal form. Adrishtapurvosmi. Adrishtapurvam, Rishitoshimi Drishtva. I'm very excited to see this universal form of yours which has never been seen before. At the same time, this frightens me. So please, Arjuna says, please show me again your four-armed personal form. Like that, here the Lord in his fearful feature as Rudra the destroyer and the punisher of the sinful. He's being prayed to, please show your more favorable, kind form. So the Lord has two kinds of, you can say bodies, what we mean is two different kinds of energies. The Lord has only spiritual bodies, and those spiritual bodies are actually full of ecstasy and all auspicious. But he has two different kinds of energies. The terrible energy, the material energy which binds the jivas, and the kind, gentle energy, the spiritual energy which liberates them. So this is a prayer to the Lord who also has his fearful aspect, who has his material energy. Praying that he'll show his transcendental form and he'll give the conditioned souls divine knowledge. O Supreme Lord Rudra, O bestower of knowledge, O Giri Shanta, which can mean giver of auspiciousness who resides on the mountains. But the poetic meaning of that is who spreads auspiciousness, sham, in Giri, which means mountain, but here means the heart. O you who bestows auspiciousness in the heart, please become manifest to us in your gentle, all auspicious Satchidananda transcendental blissful form. So Shiva is also thought of as the name of Lord Shiva, but here it's characterizing the transcendental auspicious nature of the Supreme Person and his transcendental body. These words are going to be repeated in the next verse and later verses. Shiva, which means auspicious, Tanu, body, Papa, destroyer of sins, Papa is sin, and so on. And the next verse, which also is from the Yajurveda, from the same chapter, 16th chapter, yes. It's the very next verse in the Yajurveda.
Yamishum girishantahaste bibarshi astave shivam giritratam kuru Mahimsi Purusham Jagata.
O Girishanta, you hold an arrow in your hand ready to throw it. Please make that arrow auspicious. O deliverer of the mountain, please do not destroy the world and its population. So, one way of understanding this prayer, please take this auspicious arrow, power of destruction that you're holding in your hand, and use it, throw it, to destroy, strike and destroy the obstacles that stand in the way of my spiritual realization. Please don't do violence to the world, to the helpless people who are wandering in the cycle of samsara. Please don't drag them into the blindness of illusion, in the cycle of birth and death. So he's expressing compassion here for the other living entities. And he's acknowledging that the Supreme Lord is the controller of their ignorance also. By his disfavor, they become bound by his, when he's gratified and pleased, then liberation is awarded. So, O Lord, who resides on the impassable mountains. This is a common image describing Lord Shiva, that he lives in the mountains, Kailas, and other mountains. But it can be understood that the Lord is inaccessible, that he's very difficult to understand. Still, you kindly distribute auspiciousness to all the living entities, to the living entities. Please, give that auspiciousness in the form of transcendental realization. Okay. I'm going to cover several verses, so I'm going quickly here. Any questions on those two verses? Obviously, this is meditating on the Lord in his fearful form. Text 7.
Tatak param brahma param brihantam yatanikayam savabhuteshu gurham vishvasyaikam pariveshtitaram isham tam gyatva Amrita Bhavanti.
Beyond this world is the Supreme Absolute, the Infinite Lord, who takes up his hidden residence among all creatures, in accordance with each type of body. He is the one pervader of the entire cosmos, the controller of all. Those who know him become immortal.
Okay.
So here, tatakparam, beyond that, shouldn't be understood, misunderstood as meaning beyond that Supreme Person. There's something else. Because we've stated very clearly that Brahman is the Supreme, beyond which there is no other Supreme. So we have to understand this in a different sense, beyond that, tatakparam, beyond that material world. Is the transcendental Lord. This verse repeats phrases that have been used before. Sarvabhuteshu gunam, hidden in the hearts of all living beings. The whole line, Vishvashaikam Padiveshtitaram, the one who pervades the whole universe, who envelops it, surrounds it, inside and outside. And the last line is repeated, Isham tam gyatva amita bhavanti. This has been repeated. This is repeated from previous lines, previous verses. The Lord is transcendental to the world and the jivas, greater than all of them because he's the cause of the material creation and the living entities who live in it. Someone may say, well, the creator of the world, Brahma, he himself is created. And the answer is yes, that's true. Brahma is created. But beyond him is Brahma Param, the Supreme Person, who is the ultimate controller. He's beyond even Brahma, Brahma Param. Because he's Brahma's creator. And why? Chatakparam Brahma Param Brihantam. Brihantam. Because he can be considered greater than Brahma, greater than everything and everybody. Because he's all-pervading. He's found everywhere, and everything is part of him. Everything is, he's included everywhere. Everything is included in him. And how? What evidence do we have of that? We can see that at least the yogis can see the super soul in their own heart, and that super soul is at the heart of every jiva. Yata nikayam sarvabhuteshu gudam. Hidden in the heart, taking a different form, different size. He's appearing in the size of the heart. An elephant has a big heart, fly has a small heart. The super soul appears. It says the size of a thumb, but the thumb size of each individual being. They each have different sized thumbs. Angushtamatra, the size of one thumb. Well, then another argument is, every body has a jiva. The jiva gives life to the body. Why do we have to presume the existence of some other soul, this super soul? What do we need him for? Well, the answer is, he's the one pervading everything, who doesn't depend on anyone else, and who controls everyone. The individual jivas can control their own bodies, but they can't coordinate the whole existence of the universe. And they can't even ultimately coordinate their personal existence. They have very limited control, even of their own bodies. So there's great need to understand, to accept the presence of the Supreme Controller, the Super Soul, also in everybody's heart. Okay? Then, yeah, please. That's a good question. He appears different. Well, he doesn't change. It's like a reflection. It's like a reflection in a body of water. The same moon is reflected in many different vessels of water. And the size changes according to the size of the size of the reflected image changes according to what it's reflected in. Like that, the super soul, yes, that the body changes and he'll appear to be different size. That's just an image. Or just like, you know, the movie camera, I can move it closer or further from the wall, the picture seems to get bigger, but nothing's actually changing. Just the image is changing.